Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Knockreiner. I'm too tired to come up with something interesting.
That's pretty boring. Unlike our news topics today, we're going to start... Today we'll start with an update on some Android-based ransomware, then jump into really interesting research by Kaspersky on the latest UEFI, or I guess WEFI, as we will call it, malware. Before ending with a news story on a hardware hacking group that has landed themselves in legal trouble. Let's go ahead and swim on it.
Fun drinking game. Drink every time me or Mark mess up an acronym or a name.
We're not trying to kill our audience, Corey. So let's start with our first story, and this comes from last week when Microsoft's security research team published their analysis of a pretty interesting Android ransomware strain. So they said that this new variant caught their attention because it was an advanced malware payload with unmistakable malicious characteristics and behavior, but it managed to evade many of the available protections on Android. So most Android ransomware these days, it's different than the traditional PC ransomware we see in that most of them don't actually try and encrypt all your files. Instead, they try and block you from getting into your phone.
If you don't mind me adding a little aside, I wouldn't say it's different than PC malware. It's different than modern PC malware. Ransomware. If you've listened to me and Mark, whether it's at a webinar or article, talk about the history of ransomware. Besides just generic ransomware, we often talk about modern ransomware is crypto ransomware. And that's what I think you're alluding to with encrypting files on your computer. But well before crypto ransomware, it was very common even on PC to have what we call locker ransomware. And locker ransomware is just kind of an overall term for something that tried to make your computer inoperable to you in some way. They would lock your computer up. And they do this by maybe obscuring the start button, putting Windows in some sort of kiosk mode that just showed a message. So there was something called locker ransomware that affected PCs too. Now, the good thing about locker ransomware, there's nothing good about ransomware, but from a victim perspective, locker ransomware couldn't really take control completely of your computer. There were ways for technical savvy people to get rid of this irritation of only being able to see a ransom message. You might have to boot in safe mode. You might have to do some technical tricks to get there, but it was more irritation. It wasn't super effective. Whereas crypto ransomware, locking up a file with strong encryption, it's pretty much impossible to reverse that if you use the right encryption. So anyways, just an aside that the difference between crypto ransomware and locker ransomware. And I think as you were saying, this particular variant is more like, or what we see on Android devices is much more like the locker ransomware of the past.
Yeah, instead of using encryption to encrypt all your files or images, it instead abuses functions within the system in order to display a ransom note as a message on your screen and prevent you from exiting out of that no matter what you do, basically. So in their analysis, Microsoft went over a few of the older ways ransomware used to do this. I guess the most common one up until around midway through last year abused this one permission called System Alert Window to display their note and lock access. This older permission basically gave apps the ability to place a window, so a screen or an image or something, up on the phone and with the system's group permissions in a way that it couldn't be dismissed. And it was originally designed for system alerts and errors, as you might have guessed from the name, but attackers abused it to fully occupy the screen, and there's no way to get around it at that point. It was such a problem, though, that Google actually made quite a few changes to address it in 2019, and also a lot of security solutions added signatures and heuristics to catch this behavior. So some of the things Google did back in, I think it was Android 10 or Q or whatever you want to call it when it came out. First off, they revoked this permission after 30 seconds for sideloaded apps and after on reboot for store-bought apps. This caused a few issues with some applications that had overlays, if you ever used Facebook Messenger with its little pop-up chat bubble or whatever they want to call it, that used this permission in order to facilitate it. And this would revoke that access after reboot, and you'd have to re-give it that permission in order to use it more. It also elevated the permission level to their category called above dangerous, which basically means instead of a single click to enable the permission, users had to jump through several hoops to enable it. And then they also introduced an overlay kill switch to deactivate these system alert windows too and let you get past them. So between a combination of Android-based anti-malware engines and just Google operating system changes, they pretty much fixed this particular way of deploying ransomware on a phone, or at least enforcing ransomware on a phone. So attackers have had to find other ways now. Some other methods that Microsoft noted included abusing accessibility features, but even that requires special permissions and isn't always successful since you have to have users click stuff. They also saw instances where they used infinite loops of redrawing windows, basically, where the app just basically kept reloading its window over and over and over and over again. But there are ways to get around that as well and uninstall the app. So this new variant actually abuses the call notification system and a few others that notifications that require immediate user attention. So if you have an Android phone, unlike Corey, because he's an Apple fanboy, you've probably already noticed that.
Notice there's not much locker ransomware in iOS.
There's also not much homebrew either.
Unless you jailbreak, which I don't need to do anymore because they have what I need.
When you receive a phone, that notification tends to pop up over everything else you're doing. And that is a permission that other apps can use because there are other phone apps, for example. So in the case of this ransomware, it abused that notification to pop up a window over everything else. And then it had a few other tricks to make it so you couldn't exit out of there. So the way coding works on Android when you make an app, there's a whole bunch of different callback methods, so functions you can hook into at various points throughout the app. There's one, for example, called on user leave hint, and it's designed for when the user is exiting out of the app, this fires off and lets you do something. Based off the name, I'm assuming it's so you can like leave a hint for, hey, come back later, maybe. I have no idea. But in the case of the ransomware, this function basically restarted the whole application to keep the notification up on the screen with the ransom note. So paired with that notification they found and this one function, anytime you tried to exit out of the app, it would restart it and keep it up on the phone. Kind of interesting way to abuse that.
Yeah, very, very interesting. By the way, the TLDR for the people that kind of were glassing over, really, this is a way to make a pop-up window keep on showing up on your screen over and over. And as a user in the basic touch UI, you not being too able to get rid of it. As a Android developer, there's many little tricks a malicious person could do to do this. Google's fixed some that they've used before. But this is just interesting from a technical level for the nerds out there that do Android programming because it does it slightly different. But ultimately, to the Android victim, it's just a pop-up screen that won't go away. Now, there's other interesting things about this particular locker ransomware we'll talk about. But before we do, I will say the one good thing about this is, yes, for a non-technical user, this would be a big pain in the butt to get rid of. You could probably do a complete firmware wipe and start from fresh to get rid of it. But other than that, that's kind of a hard reset. That kind of sucks. I will say, for a technical user, this is not the end of the world at all. You can reset this. Nerds out there that do use Android, and unbeknownst to Mr. Mark out there, I actually have about 6 Android devices at home, so I know it quite well. My Quest is an Android device, for that matter. But there's ADB, a command line tool where a computer can hook up to an Android device, and you could clean this up so that it wouldn't have this pop-up window. So it's not kind of unrecoverable. There's really no reason to pay this particular ransom, in my opinion, because you could clean it up without hurting your phone.
Careful with what that you admit said, to, Corey. Tim Cook's going to send the Apple police over.
That said, I do think it's interesting how they continue to play the cat and mouse game and finding new tricks in the Android SDK and what permissions and accessibility options are exposed to do this. And there's other interesting aspects of this malware, right, Mark?
Yeah. So one of the other modules that they added that Microsoft noted didn't appear to be fully set up yet, it seemed to be in testing mode basically, was they included a fork of a code library for machine learning called TinyML that they used within the app to dynamically decide what size of an image to create for the ransom note and display it on the screen, because Android phones come in all shapes and sizes. And if you try to use just a single image or even quite a few of them, they wouldn't fit every phone, so they'd get distorted as the phone tries to display it. And by having a more crisp image, it adds a little more credibility, especially considering most of the ransom notes claim to be that they were from the police or they contained explicit images supposedly found from the device. And reading that, that honestly, like, imagine if you were sitting there like in your office and all of a sudden a explicit image shows up on your phone that you can't get rid of. That would be a pretty jarring and terrifying event. And you could see why it might convince some people to actually pay the ransom to get rid of it.
And by the way, if you're a listener, this you can kind of see the evolution of ransomware here, too. You've probably heard us talk about scareware, which before the first way they started extorting us, before they even locked up our computers, were pretending to be the FBI and saying you're involved in child pornography or piracy. And if you don't pay money, the FBI will get you. So it's funny to see that even this new locker ransomware on Android is reverting to kind of old lures and social engineering tactics that have been used in ransomware all along.
Yep. To get a little
it's like Android ransomware catching up with the PC world.
Yeah. I will say, like, if we're going to talk about that, like, I don't anticipate seeing Android ransomware follow entirely in the footsteps of PC ransomware, and that crypto ransomware on Android is significantly more difficult because there are built-in permissions to prevent apps from affecting other apps. Like, the app would have to exploit a known vulnerability to gain system level privileges in order to do that, basically. Whereas on Windows, anything you launch has the permissions of your user, which can affect any other application that you have permissions to, which tends to be your whole desktop environment.
I'll also say the way we use file stores tends to be very different on a mobile device. It's not like we're manually setting a directory with all our important files. It's kind of app based. So what you would even encrypt, it would be quite different. I kind of agree with you there.
Yep.
That said, mobile phones becoming the keys, you know, your wallet, your multi-factor authentication token, there's a lot of new ways they might be able to legitimately lock you out of your life through your phone in the future. So I could see it evolving differently.
I even just read an article about Apple trying to replace paper passports by doing electronic ID wirelessly. So you could, like you said, if your whole life is on your mobile phone and there's a way to lock you out of it, it could be just as damaging as encrypting your files on your computer. To get back into a little bit of the nerdy side again on this, there were some interesting obfuscation techniques that we've seen across other malware strains too on Android. The application itself, so with Android apps, they basically have to tell the operating system what they're doing. There's this file called a manifest file that's basically a list of everything the application does and is required for Android apps. But there's ways to hide what you're doing as well. So in this case, it used a pretty common method, which included encrypted binary data in the assets directory. So normally where you would put icons and images and stuff that your app uses, they just had a binary blob that was encrypted that one of the two things actually declared in the manifest would go through, decrypt it, and then pull functions straight out of there to do the actual malicious code. It's interesting, but that's actually pretty much par for the course when it comes to Android malware these days. It's just another obfuscation method to get past engines that look for suspicious looking activities. So either way though, Microsoft said that as of yet, they hadn't seen this distributed on the Play Store itself. It seemed like it was mostly distributed on third-party sites, places where you'd have to sideload it. It was most commonly disguised as a game or something that people might load onto their phones. And we've talked about that as a delivery method for Android malware a few times. Like, I remember when Super Mario Run from Nintendo came out on Android, it came out region by region. And when folks wanted to play it in a region that it wasn't released in yet, their only option was to sideload it, which attackers abuse to put ransomware or malware on their phones as well. So just be careful where you're loading apps. Typically, in general, the Play Store is significantly safer than sideloading it. But as we've seen, even that isn't perfect either.
Yeah, and besides games, don't forget the piracy, although that's sometimes implied.
Yeah.
One of the ways you pay for piracy is bad guys like to attach things to it.
Go to sketchy sites, get sketchy things. Basically the moral of that story. So moving on, to a topic. This comes from Kaspersky's research team, where they just published their findings on a UEFI, I did say that right, yes, malware variant that they've dubbed Mosaic Regressor. And before we continue, let's have a discussion on the name they chose. How the heck did they...
I guess I haven't gone through the PDF version, but sometimes they actually get to it. I never saw anything in the write-up I read yet.
I didn't see anything in the technical docs either. I don't know. I'm starting to believe that researchers just have a random name generator of two random words they paste together.
I could see marketing departments being involved at this point. That said, we're disparaging the name, but the research is actually pretty top line.
It was. So UEFI, or Unified Extensible Firmware Interface, it's the replacement for the old BIOS system the computers used to use for managing boot sequences and loading up the operating system. UEFI, if you're a nerd like me, or anyone that's built a computer, or I guess booted a computer, you can tell the difference between it and BIOS typically because you can actually use your mouse with UEFI, whereas BIOS, you're limited to keyboard interactions. It's opened up a whole range of basically added functionality in the pre-boot cycle for a computer.
Including a lot of security capability, by the way.
Exactly.
Secure boot is much better in UEFI. Although not everyone takes advantage of that.
And UEFI has already been abused in the past. There was the LoJax malware that ESET discovered back in 2018 that Fancy Bear and SoFacey threat actors used in some of their attacks. But through the research, Kaspersky found a few examples of a compromised UEFI firmware that contained some malicious implants, as they called them, in it. And most of it, most of the tainted firmware modules came from code borrowed from Hacking Team's Vector EDK toolkit. So Hacking Team is, we've talked about them at least a couple times, I think. They're an Italian-based, quote-unquote legitimate company that develops exploits and malware for law enforcement and nation states. They were breached, I think it was back in 2015, correct me if I'm wrong, Corey. And they lost a bunch of their source code and tools and internal documentation, including this Vector EDK toolkit, which was a UEFI malware kit. So the threat actors in this case took a bunch of those and made their own changes and plopped them in this firmware. There's modules in there, for example, that allow it to hook into callbacks to trigger anytime the operating system's loaded. There's a module in there that's designed to scan the hard drive and look for an NTFS file system as used by Windows. And then there's a module in there that will save a malware payload into the Windows user's startup directory, which executes every time the computer is booted up and the user logs in. Pretty common persistence location for malware, but it's also a pretty common location for anti-malware engines to pay extra special close attention to. The reason that UEFI malware is so good in this case for the criminals, though, is that it takes place before the system even boots, or I guess during boot, so it can consistently replace any malware that these engines discover and remove from there basically every time the computer turns on.
More importantly, you could wipe your hard drive, totally format it, you could switch your hard drive, you could move the motherboard to a new computer. It's going to continually put the file on that hard drive over and over again, assuming you're booting in Windows, until you get rid of the actual infected firmware on your motherboard or in your BIOS chip or UEFI chip.
So Kaspersky wasn't exactly sure how the malware gets delivered. They suspected it could be from physical access through a USB drive that could update the firmware, or it could be through, for example, just distributions of the UEFI firmware. But they also delved deeper into it and looked at the actual malware payload itself. So in this case, the Mosaic Register malware. And it actually had some interesting functionality, too.
Regressor.
Yeah, whatever.
Mosaic Regressor.
What did I say? Register?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm thinking computers now, and same thing.
But you're right. What you've talked about so far is mostly the Hacking Team's code to get the file there, but the actual payload was very interesting in itself and is still mostly uncovered. Not mostly still covered. Basically, they've taken that initial Hacking Team Vector EDK code and they've used it to deliver their own kind of multi-staged downloader with really literal stages and where it's modularly downloading different DLL files for different things. And because they were only able to actually capture one of the libraries, one of the modules, so to speak, which was called low.rem. It's a basic document stealer, which kind of makes sense if you're assuming this is a nation state spying on the type of targets we'll talk about. They were only able to kind of map some of this entire kind of framework or platform. Likely, there's all kinds of other payloads that still haven't been discovered yet, which I thought was rather interesting.
And some of the delivery methods for those malware payloads were really interesting. Like there's the typical ones you see of just downloading it over an HTTP or HTTPS connection. But one of their methods they had in there, they actually had hard-coded email aliases ending at mail.ru, four of them, where they would log into a mailbox over either POP3 or IMAP and download malware payloads that way, just like a mail client, which is kind of interesting. And I guess they could use the same credentials to exfiltrate out data too through those mailboxes. But I don't know. I can't imagine it's the only time that's happened, but this is the first time I've seen
And mail.ru is definitely a domain that's being leveraged by a lot of threat actors, maybe not in this exact way, but no, a very, very interesting CNC for sure.
So Kaspersky did go on to state who, at least broadly, some of the victims were. Mostly they were diplomatic entities or NGOs in Africa, Asia, and Europe. And
by the way, just because I'm not sure, mostly people should know NGO is a nonprofit organization, but just wanted to make that clear.
And when trying to figure out what the link was between all these organizations, they found that just about all of them had some sort of connection to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea or North Korea, including nonprofit activity or an actual presence within the country. And through analyzing the code and some of the character sets that were used in it, they determined that the developer was at least primarily Chinese speaking, but they weren't able to attribute it to a specific group as of yet. But we can all probably guess who might be at least somewhat related to it, considering the targets.
Although it's kind of interesting, I would say the DPRK, North Korea, is rather friendly compared to a lot of countries with China. So it is interesting. I mean, they're alluding it's a nation state level attack, likely from a China speaking country, China. But it's interesting that they're targeting North Korean entities then.
Yeah. I have to imagine that the United States is spying on Canadians, for example, too. So I guarantee they're not the only ones spying on their quote unquote friendly neighbors.
Decent point.
Yeah.
One thing, by the way, definitely read. We're skimming over tons of amazing technical detail. And SecureList Kaspersky's blog actually has multiple. The blog itself, I would argue, is amazingly technical detailed. But then they have a PDF version that goes into, I didn't know how they could get more detail, but oh my gosh. So very interesting read if you're really technically inclined, if you want to get down to code samples and specific obfuscation techniques. Really good research by Kaspersky for sure.
Yep. And otherwise, make sure you don't install random UEFI firmware packages from the internet, especially.
By the way, we did skip that, didn't we? I mean, as you mentioned, they didn't figure out the infection methodology, but we should talk about that. This could be one, a supply chain hack. And by supply chain, I mean a manufacturing supply chain. There have been instances where devices and even firmwares, in this case, you buy a motherboard from a company, you could have it pre-infected because some attack threat actor found a way to hijack the supply chain and kind of infect a firmware image. Other than that, I would assume the two other methods would be a USB key. You could have a USB key with scripting. Usually when you're purposely upgrading your motherboard's firmware or the UEFI. I'll say the acronym. UEFI. when you're updating that, usually you might put a file on a USB drive, boot from that, and their script to help update your firmware. The other option is nowadays, a lot of motherboard manufacturers have online update capability where they'll actually go and grab an update via the internet, because they, like you said, one of the features is you can boot into UEFI with a mouse and network capability. But of course, that would imply some sort of vulnerability in the update mechanism or some sort of hijacking of a motherboard manufacturer. And Kaspersky hasn't found any evidence of this. But the point being is this is kind of not the easiest. I guess you might be able to download malware, that the malware automatically updates your firmware UEFI, but that would be pretty hard to do. And you'd have to target the motherboard to the exact hardware model. So anyways, it's a harder than usual type of infection to get. But those are some of the potential ways that I can think of. I don't know if you have any others, Mark.
No, and they did actually note in their article, they were discussing some of like hack team's methods. Like they even had slide decks from the original hacking team's leak, basically showing how to create one of these bootable USB thumb drives where you just plug it in and reboot the computer and then boom, it's infected. So that is a potential method, especially when you're talking about nation state attacks where these company or these countries potentially have the resources to accomplish that.
If you have physical access, that's kind of the main end game. And by the way, some of the biggest threats in the world, like Stuxnet, all started by getting an agent to have a USB key that they walked in. So sometimes the USB key is necessary.
Yep.
At least physical access could protect you a little.
Exactly. I would say it's a little more difficult with like malware doing it because you would at least need system level permissions. There's got to be some notifications and stuff that gets thrown anytime you try and update Wi-Fi from the operating
system. And they
system.
Might even be Wi-Fi level ones that are not easy. What I mean by that is, you know, there are mechanisms where Windows can ask you, are you, you know, when it's doing the, what do they call it? The second admin confirmation.
Yep.
Why can't I think of that?
User
acronym?
Access control.
Yes. That one.
UAC.
Yeah. But so that is sometimes harder for malware to kind of do tricks to say yes to that without your help. But there is always, people have found methods to get past it. So I guess it is possible.
This UEFI is pretty sneaky, is what we're getting at. All right. So let's move on to the final news topic. This one actually originates from a couple weeks ago, although I'd say it dates back to a decade and a half ago, where 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Justice announced the arrest of two members of what they labeled the notorious video game piracy group known as Team Executor. So they arrested a gentleman named Gary Bowser and another one named Max Laurent, who were picked up in the Dominican Republic and France, respectively. And they also indicted a third individual named Yuanan Chen from Shenzhen, China. Who was also indicted on those charges. And I'm sorry to all three of you for entirely butchering your names, except for Gary Bowser, because that's easy, because they're video game hackers. So Team Executor has actually been around for well over a decade. Like, I remember them back in 2001, 2003 or so. They were the biggest manufacturers of original Xbox mod chips. That's basically their claim to fame.
Yeah, and I think we both had some of their mod chips, although I started with even an earlier one. Both of us are into hardware hacking in some cases. I've modded many consoles. Obviously, as we'll get into, piracy is one of the reasons some people mod. But for security nerds, it's more about kind of defeating the system to allow it to do what you want. And things like homebrew, there is actually a lot of homebrew software you can load on devices. One of my favorites was XBMC, by the way, that I think we probably both used on one of the original Xbox consoles, Xbox Media Center. It was basically something that could turn your Xbox into a home theater system.
It was honestly awesome at the time, because this was back when like TiVos cost hundreds of dollars with like massive monthly fees, and with just a $30 or so mod chip, some soldering skills, and a cracked version of a game, you could hack your Xbox and load up XBMC and turn it into an entire, like you said, home entertainment system.
Not necessarily a cracked version of the game. You're not pirating game. It's the original. It's a particular legal copy of a game that happens to have a vulnerability. Some of the original ones were in like save files because, you know, the input and output that a game takes that you might be able to mess with for memory corruption are save files. So yeah. I remember some of the early ones being corrupted save files.
Splinter Cell was one of them I used, and like MechAssault or something like that was another one. Yeah.
So anyways, it's just fascinating for security folks to do. I think you and I have a long history of, you know, I definitely knew of executor.
Yeah, like the Executor 3, I probably bought 20 of them in the early 2000s. But they've been sticking around since then, cracking other consoles, jailbreaking other consoles, developing these chips to make it so even, you know, 12-year-olds like I was at the time, make it easy for them to jailbreak and load homebrew on their systems. But as
it kind of lowered the bar too. I feel like I remember that one of the chips, maybe the one you're talking about, didn't require soldering. Some of my early mod chips had like 29 solder points, and they weren't just on the PCB. Some of them were literally on the pins of the CPU, which so easy to actually, you know, connect and bridge circuits doing that. So I remember them actually creating kits that could just sit on top of something with almost no soldering skills. But they actually, a lot of people did not like them as, you know, there's a lot of security folks involved with this sort of modding community, because it's more about trying to defeat the protection locking you out of a system. Andrew Bunny Huang, he was one of the original people that found the first Xbox vulnerability that was used to make one of the first mod chips. And they kind of open sourced all this. From what I understand, Executor tended to take other people's cracks or found vulnerabilities and kind of just make a business out of it.
Yeah. And they would also, like recently, they even put it behind their own license, which is a little bit ironic, where you would have to license their operating system full of stuff to break other licensed software, basically. There's been accusations in the modding community of them stealing open source code without abiding by the licenses in those and sticking in their operating system, sometimes with obfuscation to hide the fact they stole it. So even though like it was very, very much a mixed bag with them of, you know, they lowered the bar to make it so anyone could modify their consoles. Like one of their latest ones on the Nintendo Switch, you didn't even need to solder. You just need to put this thing in there. But at the same time, they were definitely ripping off other people that were doing it just for fun and games, basically. But one of the things with this whole modding scene is everyone kind of like tries to avoid talking about the elephant in the room, which is piracy. Like more often than not, these chips enable you to play cracked games or ROMs or download your own games onto your storage and then play them without the cartridge or the disc. And people that participate in this industry are very aware of the illegality of that and avoid mentioning it. And Team Executor and these individuals that were picked up by the police appear to have not been so covert or sneaky about the obvious illegal activity for this.
By the way, I would go as far as to say a lot of the community that's doing this legitimately isn't into piracy. Like if you know the hacking mentality, just some people want to jailbreak just to show that they did it and to get root. And even like there is a community of homebrew folks that just like that. And of course, I mentioned XBMC. But I would say for a lot of the vulnerability hunters, their kind of adrenaline rush and happiness is finding the flaw and proving they can do it. And then they step away and probably don't even leverage it. So, yeah. But definitely, as you mentioned, Team Executor, I'm sure we'll get into it, but they would attach to things like ROM packs and emulators. Again, by the way, an emulator itself is not illegal, but running a ROM of something that's pirated is.
So ROM, by the way, is basically the bundled code for a video game or a piece of software in this case. And the indictments had email evidence from Bowser and a few others of the indicted individuals talking about setting up an underground forum, for example, with protected servers for distributing these ROM packs, because their products, basically a lot of their allure came from people wanting to run these ROMs, so they needed to protect their ability to download them, even if they are illegal and breaking copyright laws left and right. So in the end, they were indicted on, I think I counted, 11 different counts, 5 counts of wire fraud, which the federal government was able to step in on because a lot of the network connections cross state lines. I found it kind of interesting reading the indictment because they're talking about these investigators based out of the Seattle area, out of the FBI's like Western Washington office, where they went and purchased some of these devices, these mod chips basically. And they noted that they connected to servers based out of Portland, so it crossed state lines, and so now it's federal jurisdiction. I thought that was kind of interesting, even though it's, like, you know, technically the way the law works. They were also indicted on a count of conspiracy to commit technological measures and traffic in circumvention devices. This was because of their plans to develop and sell some of these devices with ROMs pre-installed. Like, they had a product that was basically a ripoff of the Super Nintendo Classic, which Nintendo created with, I think, 30 or so games built onto it, old Super Nintendo games. Team Executor were developing one where they were trying to fit 700 games on it. Obviously, they did not have the rights to distribute that copyrighted content, so that's one foot very much across the line when it comes to modding. There were four counts of trafficking and circumvention devices, one for each of these different mod chips they've made recently, and then one count of money laundering, basically because they made transactions of more than $10,000 that was derived from criminal activity. So they're in a bit of a world of pain right now with the federal government because of they're basically crossing the line. And I mentioned to you, Corey, offline, like before we chatted about this, I was ready to hop on my high horse of we shouldn't be going after people that make mod chips because they're not distributing anything bad. But in this case, they were clearly breaking the law. And based off the evidence, the email evidence that the FBI was able to obtain, they knew they were doing it too. They knew it was shady.
Yeah. I will say there's probably some discussion worth having here about the law. Like, I think you and I probably agree that, you know, whether or not people succumb to this in their younger life and piracy should be illegal and it's bad. People make things, it costs money, you should pay for them. That said, you know, you mentioned one thing, conspiracy to circumvent technology measures versus trafficking in circumvention devices and plans to sell pirated stuff. Like, I do have some of the issue, the security research side of me, with conspiracy to circumvent technological measures. Researchers need to be free to be able to hunt and find vulnerabilities and to be able to prove weaknesses in any type of security, hardware security, software security, etc. I do not think it should be illegal for folks to find these vulnerabilities, whether they be in a particular game or the console's code itself. Folks like Andrew Bunny Huang are eventually finding really big security vulnerabilities in these systems that give you root. And once disclosed to Nintendo, Microsoft, whoever, that can actually make the security of the device better. So I don't think there should be illegality to circumventing technology measures, if it, you know what I mean? Now, what you do with that, and maybe that even extends to the mod chip itself, a mod chip that gives you root to do what you will on a device, maybe that shouldn't be illegal either. Now, where it crosses the line is what you use that root capability to. If you're pirating, and especially if you're selling pirated technology and selling pre-installed pirated stuff, clearly illegal. They deserve to be absolutely punished for that. But I don't want laws that limit the ability of researchers to actually find and share these vulnerabilities, because ultimately, if the companies are paying attention, they can make their devices better.
And technically, like, it wasn't even until like October of 2016, I think, where it became legal in some cases to circumvent technologies for DRM, for example. Like the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act, basically outlawed that. It made it illegal even for white hat hackers. And it wasn't until 2016 where they added exemptions for good faith attempts to better security, basically. So good faith white hat hacking. And that still, I think last I read, it has to be extended every 2 years. And there's the chance that they could potentially take that away. Not that we have any issues with our current government and going backwards on technological laws or anything, but it is a genuine potential risk. I am in agreement with you, though. Like, I think we need to allow people to hack their own systems, but I also fully understand the line of between that and piracy, and in this case explicitly enabling piracy, and not even just enabling it but participating in it.
And frankly, you know, I definitely modded my own device for fun, and I personally modded a few friends for free, but I used to see folks that offered modding as a service, and usually a lot of them had this little less marketed line where they'd give you a hard drive or load your Xbox with pirated games. That is clear. You know, I have nothing against the modders, but that load it with pirated stuff, No way.
Yep. I did a lot of modding back in the day too, but I was very careful to include the, I'm sure, totally legit statement in there of saying you cannot use this for piracy, that I'm sure would have fully worked if I had ever been picked up by authorities.
That would stand up in court.
Yeah. Whatever. I was 13 years old. No one's going to arrest me.
Yeah. And by the way, I think that kind of exploration is what makes a lot of security experts security experts.
Exactly. I will say, like, I hope someone picks up the mantle. I hope someone a lot less shady, at least, picks up the mantle of developing these chips that help lower the bar for people for hardware hacking. Because
well,
this
if
does...
our yeah, yeah. I actually don't think there's a worry there. And I think there's an Ars Technica article that we both read that's really good on this particular case. And at the end, realize that Executor Team is basically almost a piracy group modding team. They're not the ones behind these hacks. The mod community itself, although I think there's a little fear there that they'll be cracked down, essentially thinks that, you know, the authorities are going after the folks that pirated and sold stuff. The actual community that's coming together to do the security research is safe. So I don't think the mod community will go away at all.
Yep. And that is good news. And until then, I'm going to go try and find my original Xbox out of storage, because I just realized that it's worth quite a bit of money now because it has that Executor 3 chip in it.
By the way, I have one too. I don't know exactly. It's in the house. I never sold it. I wonder if it boots. It has my XBMC hard drive in it for sure. So I wonder, how much was it worth again?
I saw one on there for $1,000 and the chip itself for
$400. Oh, that's nuts. Wow.
Yeah. Especially because it was like $35 back in the day.
I wonder what my old early modded PS2 is worth.
I imagine probably a decent amount as well. So I guess we can go ahead and end this, and I'm going to go run to my storage unit.
Yeah, let's go dig up some stuff to buy the new PS5 and Xbox, whatever it's called.
If you can get a pre-order. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Now that you're drunk from all that drinking, drink a lot of water.
Except not too much, because that'll kill you too.
I think it's like a dump truck worth to kill you. Water poisoning is pretty darn hard to do.